about Disney Issues. I'm your host, Hugh LaFollette. On the show this week, I'll be talking to David Schmitz, professor of philosophy and economics at the University of Arizona, and our topic will be private property. David, glad to have you on the show.
Thank you, Hugh.
Okay, what we're going to do is we want to focus on the issue of private property, but what I'd like to do is to get you to say a little bit about what you mean by property first, and then we can wind our way to talking specifically about private property.
Okay, well, suppose you own an acre of land, and we might say the land itself is your possession. Your property then, or your property right, would consist in what you have a right to do with it. So the right to sell that land or build a house on it, cut down trees you find on it, dig for minerals, or build a fence around it and put up a no trespassing sign. Those are different rights that make up the bundle of rights that we call property, in short.
Okay, and those rights are going to be true not only of private property, but of what you also talk about as community or communal property as well, correct?
Yes, I would suppose so. I mean, the difference is would be in the who the owners are, what kind of decision-making entity has those rights, rather than a difference in the rights per se. I suppose that's the best way to look at it.
Okay, so it would be fair to say that you use the language of decision-making, that one thing that's crucial about your understanding of private property or any other kind of property is that the people who own it have some kind of decision-making power about the use of that property.
Yeah, and especially that they have the right to exclude, as I call it. I mean, the right to exclude is the right of an owner to say no, whether it's the National Park Service exercising sort of that kind of right over a national park, or whether it's a private homeowner. So if someone walks up and says, I think I'll dump my trash here, the owner has the right to say no. If someone walks up and says, well, that corn crop looks very tasty, I think I'll help myself, the owner has the right to say no. And the way I see it is that that right to say no is fundamental, because within the realm of objects that can be covered by a property right, that fundamentally, that right to say no, what you have created by, protected by that right, is a class of owners who have the right to trade, basically, to produce for the purpose of mutually beneficial trade. And you also have owners who have the right to take responsibility for protecting the land against what we call a tragedy of the commons. I mean, to make long-term decisions. And if I could just say a note about that, about what I mean by the tragedy of the commons, you could imagine a pasture. No one owns it. Anyone who wants can graze sheep on it. So suppose more and more shepherds keep showing up with more and more sheep, and eventually there are too many, and the land is going to be degraded and ruined. If there's no one who has the right to exclude, no one who has the right to say no, to say, this has to stop, you have to leave, or you can't have that many sheep here, without that, the land is ruined. And that right to say no is, as I see it, really the heart of a property right.
Okay, one other point of clarification
sure,
too, about this notion of exclusion. Exclusion, it does not have to be in whole. It can be in part. And it can be, I can exclude one person but not another. I can exclude one person in some ways and exclude someone else in another way. So, for example, if I own property, I can rent it to you. And so, therefore, once I sign the contract renting it to you, I can't exclude you anymore, at least during the time of the contract, but I can still exclude someone else.
Yep, that's an excellent point, and that's why property theorists talk in terms of bundles. So you might say, this land is open to the public for use, but say not for alcohol consumption, or you can't sleep over here, or this land is for hiking, but you can't dump garbage here. Or for hundreds of years, there have been sort of easements, right, to say this beachfront property is the private owner's property, but even though the private owner has all of the other trappings of what we call a property right, that owner still can't stop the public in general from using the beach for their own enjoyment. But these people who have the right to access to the beach, they don't have the right to build a house there. So the house owner or the property owner retains all the rest of the bundle. And these easements have historically been really crucial because there have traditionally been easements for the purpose of travel. Like you can cross a person's land in order to reach the marketplace. The owner has to leave a corridor for free travel. But even though everyone has the right to cross the land, they don't have the right to stop and pick the owner's corn.
Okay, that's a good example. In fact, if we have time, I want to come back and talk a little bit more about that notion of bundles. But let me ask here, I know one of the things that you're concerned about is that you want to ask the circumstances or why it was justifiable to appropriate unowned property. Maybe you can explain the question. I mean, why should we now ask ourselves or be worried about justifying the appropriation of unowned property at some time in the past?
Well, I think lots of people are interested in it, and different people have different reasons. But to me, there are two things that make that especially interesting. One, there's a moral issue. I mean, if you think about history, and if we go back far enough, all current property at some point, traces back to some act of original appropriation. And so if original appropriation isn't justified, then everything gets called into question. I mean, it raises questions about the moral status of all property, and not even just private property, but government property, too. What gives a government the right to declare itself the owner of a certain property? So there's that moral issue. And second, I also think that it's pretty clear that there's a practical issue about the flood of new property that continues to be discovered and appropriated today. I mean, today the big issue isn't so much about land as about something that's become vastly more valuable than land ever was, namely information. So if you discover a gene sequence or a manufacturing process or you invent a new kind of computer chip, what makes you the owner? I mean, is it enough to say that you got there first? Well, part of the question there is enough for what exactly? I mean, how long do you have a right to say no to all the would-be competitors who want to use your invention? I mean, does it revert to the public domain at some point, or is it yours forever? I mean, these are extremely important questions right now, and so billions of dollars ride on them. So I think anyone who thinks original appropriation isn't one of the most important issues of our time just hasn't been paying attention.
Okay, what briefly does justify original appropriation? And I know specifically you're concerned about limitations on initial appropriation. So if you could say something about both of those.
Yeah, well, it's a great question and a fair question. I'm not sure there is a brief answer to it, but I could just say one of the things that I focused on is an idea originating with John Locke, where John Locke was discussing limitations on what we can justifiably appropriate. And he said one thing is that we have to leave enough and as good for others, one of his phrases. And, well, why? I think it's important to understand that Locke is thinking about a situation where there is no existing owner. There is no one who has the right to say no. There's no one who has the right to exclude. So we don't have to get permission from anyone. There's no one who has the right even to give us permission exactly. So what do? Well, we can think that even if no one owns the land, there may be other people using it, or if not now, then someday. I mean, future generations maybe would have an interest in using the land. So we have to take their interests into account, not as owners, but as users. And so to do that, Locke thought, well, it ought to be sufficient just to make sure we aren't making those people worse off, we leave them whole, as the lawyers say, and some philosophers think that that's necessary as well. In terms of, I might say something about why future generations, you might say that, here's how I see it. I think that in terms of modern environmental economics and environmental ethics, you can interpret the proviso as a call for sustainable use, really. As a society, we're here for the long run, and there isn't any point when we can just cut the issue off and say we don't care what happens after that. Particular individuals may not care, of course, but that's one of the reasons why society needs a certain amount of regulation, and that would include recognizing the right of property owners to appropriate the land and get it out of the commons and protect it from individuals who don't care. And also whether people care is to some extent a variable too. That's affected by institutional structure. I mean, if somebody owns a car, they tend to care about the car's long-term future. But if it's just a rental car, well, people simply don't care as much. So if you want people to care, one of the secrets is to give them ownership. And I mean, in some sense, you can develop that, but that's going to be the key to why appropriation is justified. It's necessary to induce the kind of caring that we want.
Okay, in fact, that's tied up with what seems to me, as I understand, to be central to your view. When people think about appropriation, there is a tendency to think of it as a zero-sum game. And what I mean by zero-sum game is if I appropriate it, then you don't have it. It's not there for you or anyone else to obtain. You think that's a mistake. And, in fact, earlier you mentioned the notion of the tragedy of the commons. Maybe there are a couple of points here that you really need to develop. One is why on a commons, on your view, the commons may actually be a negative-sum game, that we're made worse off by having a commons, by not allowing appropriation. And briefly then, why you think that appropriation is a positive sum gain, why you think we're all made better off by appropriation. I mean, you hinted at that just a moment ago in talking about responsibility, but maybe you could develop both of those ideas some.
Okay, that's fair enough. Let me give an example of a commons before appropriation, if I may. It's an issue I've been paying attention to for several years in the news. In the Philippine and Tongan Islands and elsewhere, people once fished the coral reefs with lures and traps and so on, but recently they've caught on to a technique called bleach fishing, which involves dumping bleach into the reefs, and fish can't breathe sodium hypochlorite, so they suffocated. They float to the surface, and they become an easy crop to collect. Now, the problem is that the coral itself is composed of living animals, and so the coral suffocates along with the fish, and the dead reef is no longer a viable habitat. Just in passing, another technique, blast fishing, involves dynamiting the reefs, and so the concussion likewise produces an easy harvest of stunned fish, but also dead coral. Now, okay, so we've got an environmental disaster going on here, and you can say people ought to be more responsible and they ought to preserve the reefs for their children, but I think that would miss the point, because the point is that the individual fishermen don't have the right to say no. They don't have the option of saving the coral for their children. I mean, they obviously have the option of not destroying it themselves, but what happens if they decide not to destroy it? Well, what they want is for the reef to be left for their children, but what's actually happening is that the reef is simply left for the next blast fisher down the line. So this is a tragedy of the commons. If the fisherman wants to have anything at all to give his children, he needs to act quickly, destroying the reef and grabbing the fish for himself. It does no good to tell fishermen to take responsibility. They are taking responsibility for their children. So what we have is situation where existing institutional arrangements don't empower them to take responsibility in a way that would save the reef. So to really save the reef, the fishermen need to have the right to say no, and they need to be able to enforce that right. They have to be able to exclude blast fishers. So that's the situation before appropriation. I mean, it's not a time capsule. It's a situation that's subject to ruinous pressure. Now, what happens after that? What happens once we appropriate? Well, as you indicated, philosophers writing about original appropriation, they tend to speak as if people who arrive first are luckier than those who come later. And the truth is, first appropriators begin the process of resource creation, and it's latecomers that get most of the benefits. I mean, think about it historically. Consider America's first permanent English settlement, the Jamestown colony of 1607, or if you want to go back earlier than that, people crossing the Bering Strait from Asia 12,000 years ago. Now, I mean, you could ask, was their situation better than ours because they got there first? I mean, they did get there first, but what was so much better about it? I mean, was it that they never had to worry about being overcharged for car repairs, or never woke in the middle of the night to the sound of noisy refrigerators or leaky faucets or flushing toilets, never had to change a light bulb? I mean, that's the comparison, I think. I mean, philosophers are taught, in effect, to say that original appropriators got all the good stuff for free, and we have to pay for the ugly leftovers. But I think, in truth, original appropriation benefits latecomers far more than it benefits the original appropriators themselves. I mean, the people who got here first never dreamt of the things that we take for granted. I mean, the poorest among us have life expectancies exceeding theirs by several decades. It's not just a theory, that's how it is. So the bottom line then is that original appropriation diminishes the stock of what can be originally appropriated, at least in the case of land, but that's not the same as diminishing the stock of what can be owned. On the contrary, in taking control of resources and thereby removing those particular resources from the stock of goods that can be acquired by original appropriation, I think people typically generate massive increases in the stock of goods that can be acquired by trade. So it's important to remind ourselves, what is the prize exactly in this race? And the bare fact of being an original appropriator, that's not the prize. The prize is prosperity. And it's latecomers who win big, courtesy of those who got here first. That's how I see it.
All right, that leads us in the last 9 minutes of the show or so to try to talk about, I mean, you certainly hinted at it already, about the relative merits of private property over communal property. And part of what you've done in saying that a commons is a bad idea is you said that we need some kind of property. The question is, what kind of property? Do we need property that's primarily owned by individuals, or property primarily owned by communities or groups? Maybe you could talk a little bit about the relative merits of both of those, and at least point the direction in which way you think we should go.
I think it's one of the most difficult general questions in property theory, and I think it's salient as some of the best property theorists, people like Carol Rose and Robert Ellickson, have said, that you never see purely private regimes. I mean, even the most privatized of cultures and communities will have some elements of public property, and completely public regimes tend to be catastrophic. The regimes that stand the test of time seem to be regimes that are maybe fundamentally and primarily private, but not totally private. I mean, they're a mix, and the optimal mix is going to vary from place to place. It's going to depend on circumstances. So theoretically, I mean, you could say private property is property with a single owner, whereas communal property is property shared by multiple owners. Obviously, that's a limiting case. I mean, if we look at it that way, most of what we call private property involves some degree of communal living. So Ellickson refers to the family household as America's most successful commune, I think, for example. But there's a point in looking at the extremes, because when you have a single owner, you have a person who has the maximum incentive to make good long-term decisions regarding how the land is used, because insofar as a decision affects that property, that single owner gets all the benefits and pays all the costs, and so that induces the maximum sense of responsibility. Now, the problem, the reason why it's probably not true that everything should be private, is because there's a lot of events that don't just affect the property, that spill over to affect the neighbors and the community. So, again, using an idea of Ellickson's and a fellow named Harold Demsetz as well, you might say that an individual sheep eating grass in the pasture, that's what we call a small event. And when the commons is being ruined by these essentially small events, people adding too many sheep to the stock, there's an easy and obvious solution, and we see it everywhere, which is cut the land into parcels. If we cut the land into private parcels, then what your sheep eat is of no concern to anyone else. The grass is no longer a common pool resource, and the problem's been solved. But that's a small event, and events do come in more than one size. So if we suppose that underneath the pasture it turns out that there's a pool of oil, and maybe six parcels are distributed over the pool in such a way that, right, via oil wells, owners have access to the pool, but they interfere with each other trying to draw oil from it. I mean, that one wellhead reduces the pressure available to another wellhead. So you've got a group of neighbors who have a conflict, and privatization doesn't solve the conflict. However, even here, privatization has advantages, and Ellickson says privatization is clearly superior as a solution here. Why? Because it immediately restricts the number of potential users to six neighbors, so it avoids that potential avalanche of transient users whose only concern is to get while they can, while they can. Another virtue of privatization is that if there are disputes about how the resource should be handled, at least the disputes are left in the hands of people in the vicinity who, well, there's some tendency for them to have a better understanding of local conditions. So they're in a better position to devise compromises that don't have harmful, unintended consequences. But the biggest problem is with the biggest kinds of events. Suppose one of the wells catches fire, spilling smoke over this widespread area, so leaving large numbers of people worse off. Now we're faced with a large event, and I think the conclusion that we're driven to here is that there is no final solution to how to deal with large events. There's no kind of regime that really effectively solves them. Central planning it has a history of leading to, you know, extremely sort of broad-ranging, far-flung environmental catastrophes. But private property isn't really a solution either. And so property theorists tend to say that there's no general answer to the question of which regime best deals with them. So privatization has tremendous virtues, but we shouldn't think of it as a panacea, and we shouldn't think that all forms of privatization are equal as ways of avoiding commons problems. And also, privatizing land fails to solve a whole class of problems, external effects spilling over to degrade resources like air and water that remain in a common pool.
Okay. We've just got about 3.5 minutes here. I wonder if we could focus on one issue which comes up really a couple times in what you're talking about. The idea that within an institution of private property, when I'm primarily the person influenced or affected by it, that I think the language you used, I'm going to be maximally responsible for it. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about why you see that to be true.
We could go back to the car rental example and say, look, if the car belongs to you, then you're in a situation where if there's any profit to be made in terms of the car's enduring resale value, you get all of that profit. And so you have as much of an economic incentive as you could possibly have to take sort of optimal care of the car. You could take excessive care, right? I mean, you could invest in the car in ways that don't make any sense, but your private ownership also induces you to not take excessive care of it. Now, if we compare that to a situation where you aren't the owner, where you're just renting the car or leasing the car, and at the car wash they ask you whether you want to put the special undercoating on to protect against rust, you say, well, no, why should I? And I think that's a particularly sort of graphic and familiar example, but people see that as being an example of a very general case, that if you have the right to own, to make judgments about the property, to pay the cost of your decisions and to reap the benefits of your decisions indefinitely, that reconciles your interests with the community's interests as much as we could ask.
Okay, it turns out we've only got just about a minute left. I'd like to give you a chance to sort of sum up or make any final points you'd like to make for the listener.
I think you've asked all the right questions, and so there's not too much more we need to say by way of summary. I do think there's an issue here about a fundamental issue about balancing private and community interests. And with some kinds of activities, private property has decisive advantages, but with other kinds of large events, property theorists call them, we really have a balancing act. And the thing to strive for above all is to have a system that reduces the tension between private and public interest in the first place, and a system where the preeminent way of making yourself better off is through mutually advantageous exchange on mutually agreeable terms. That's the kind of resolution to hope for and to shoot for.
All right. Well, thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
Thank you very much. It's been great.
I've been speaking today with David Schmitz, professor of philosophy and economics at the University of Arizona. And our topic has been private property. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.